right. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to The Evolution of a Snake. I am Zach.
And I'm Madeline.
And today we are bringing you Evermore Ology, following up from our Folklore Ology episode, which was very well received. Thank you to all of our fans for continuing to be fans of us celebrities.
Yes.
So we wanted to do another episode because we are desperately avoiding going back to the old format, which is just like hell on earth trying to do.
No, like we're about to get into like the 1989 era shit. And I honestly have to tell you, I don't think I'm emotionally ready.
No, I'm not.
And we've had like years.
Yeah, this podcast has been going for like 2 years. That's really weird to think about, given lack of content that we keep giving the girlies. So you can all stop attacking us for the next 6 months because we have an episode.
Yeah, you have an episode.
So leave us alone. The 2013 one is in the works. I'm still doing the plan. Still, I've been doing it for like 6 months. 2013 is just like the beginning though, which is why it's so scary, because the next years after that, it's just going to be fucking chaos.
It's going to be like, there's going to be like 1989 part six.
It's going to be like Taylor went on Good Morning America 13 times. Here is every single outfit that she wore. Like, it's just going to be too much for us. So Evermore, I think we should start and talk about like our initial impressions, because yet again, I woke Madeline up with a frantic text.
The fact that it was literally like I was in Groundhog Day. It was the same fucking day that I had already lived. Zach is waking me up. I seen the fucking thing. I got on Instagram. I woke Mason up. He was mad. It was literally the same fucking thing again.
This stupid bitch coming out with more. I don't understand how she's doing it. This is just, I think for us, especially as longtime stans, it's been very difficult to handle this surprise release and this amount of content because we're simply just not used to getting fed like this. So I was honestly upset when I saw the announcement. I was like actually angry at her. I was like, I can't do this again. Like, that's too much.
Exactly how I felt. I was like, not again. Not again. Like, I can't. But I did.
And then I was looking at the track list and trying to like figure out what the songs were about. And I was like, this is fucking pointless. Who knows? Who knows?
Exactly. Because I was wrong about more than half of Folklore. So I was like, why am I even fucking bothering? I mean, I did it.
But we did.
I knew it was stupid the entire time.
You and I had very, I think, different responses to Evermore once we heard it. I think my prediction for it was that it was going to be just a continuation of Folklore, but maybe with some more upbeat moments. And I think that was true. That was like an accurate representation of what the album was going to be. I know, Madeline, you were scared that you were going to hate it. And I think I like this more than Folklore.
I do. And I would never say that one is better than the other, because honestly, at this point, I'm not sure. But I mean, my personal opinion.
Why do we have to tear two brilliant women down?
Exactly. But like, if you're asking me, like, which one is sort of like more my speed, I would definitely say Evermore is sort of more my bag.
We have two little fandom dramas to discuss, and we'll briefly go through the Zane Lowe interview before we get into the album. So the two dramas, one was the domestic violence scandal,
which I didn't even fucking know about. Zach had to tell me.
I actually alerted you to both of these dramas.
You alerted me.
I just worry that we are going down a horribly wrong path as Swifties. And the fact that Taylor is, I mean, we're going to get into this, but the fact that she's basically announced that she's going on a hiatus, that we are not helping. We are pushing her towards the door by doing this crazy shit. So if you're not aware, basically what happened was Taylor was doing some interview with Jimmy Fallon. And I guess she did something with her hand that made people think she was a victim of domestic violence, calling out for help. And like just saying those words,
it's fucking insane,
ridiculous. And it got so bad that they removed the video from the Jimmy Fallon YouTube channel and edited it out, which I mean, only gives credence to the conspiracy theorists that something needs to be hidden, which is just, girls, it's not true.
It's just not
Leave
true.
Her alone. It's just not fucking true. She loves her London boys. Yeah, How many times does she have to tell us?
I mean, and
she told us in so many ways.
And you're totally right, because that's the kind of shit that I think happens that makes Taylor say, you know what? I've had enough. That is exactly the kind of shit that she does
Take
not like.
Take me to the lakes all the pop stars went to die. Yeah. I want to go there. She is packing her bags and moving to the lakes as we speak.
Thanks to you people.
With total disrespect to your elders, us, who have been here for so long and do not do this crazy shit.
No, I would never in a million years think, I mean, I don't even know what gives people the balls to say shit like that. out of their fucking necks.
There's no point even trying to debunk this theory because that would be giving it respect.
I mean, the fact of the matter is I just don't care because I know it ain't shit.
I know so it ain't shit. Even if it is shit, it's none of our fucking business. So shut your mouths is my message to the Swifties. Yeah. It's shut up and log off. Another thing to talk about in terms of shutting up and logging off would be the picture scandal. Now, we may enter some hot water for even discussing this because the Swifties had such a violent reaction to it. But you know what? I am fearless. Like Taylor Swift, I'm fearless.
But here's the thing is that, okay, I Googled because I wanted to know because I have seen nobody on the TL brought it up. Nobody. I was like, well, can you find this fucking picture? So I Googled. I was like, Taylor Swift picture. And all there were articles of people being like, Swifties, Barry picture. That's it. That's all you can find.
And the picture wasn't there. That's crazy. We're so powerful.
We cannot find the picture.
Well, I got my hands on the picture and then I sent it to Madeline. So
I've seen it. That makes us terrible people. Here's the fucking thing. It's not even that juicy.
No, it's not.
Like, I get, like, I understand, like, they're not wrong. Like, it's an invasion of privacy, blah, blah, blah. She didn't want us to see it, so he shouldn't look at it, blah, blah, blah. But it's nothing. Like, I'm telling you right now, it ain't nothing.
If anything, it's just surreal to see Taylor like doing something normal. I think that is the weirdest part of it all to me is that like I felt like I shouldn't see that photo. Like, it's just, it's not for me.
Exactly. That's exactly how it feels to look at it. It's like, I don't want to see this.
I really don't want to see this. And you know what? I will say it made me look at Joe in a different light.
He looked pretty good in that picture.
He looked really good. I would swipe right. And Taylor looked great too.
Yeah. Oh my, she looks really good in a pink wig. I was shook. I wonder if she's ever actually, because I, you know, people say she wears like a brown wig when she goes out. I've heard that before. Went with Joe. That's how she doesn't get recognized when they want to go out. Well, it's fucking, I wonder if she goes out wearing that pink wig. But at this point, wouldn't you be able to recognize Joe?
You would think so. But most people outside of Swifties, like, don't know who he is because he is a nobody. I'm sorry. Like, he actually is a nobody. So what are you supposed to do with that information?
In spite of what they try to convince us, he is no one.
In spite of all that London boy fanfare, he could be any old London boy on the streets of Hackney.
Yeah.
I mean, how do I feel about that? I think it was an invasion of privacy for sure. I am kind of glad that Swifties buried it because I know for sure Taylor would not like that. 100%.
Yeah, 100%. And then, man, it is buried deep. It is really buried.
Oh, I think it will never see the light of day, which is pretty impressive given the amount of like celeb nudes that get leaked. Yeah. It's not even a nude. That's not what it is.
See, that's another part of the reason why it's not blowing up is because if it was a nude, you couldn't bury that. But because it's so uninteresting, yet bury it deep, deep down.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like the news outlets saw it and they were like, you know what? I mean, this is like a PG version of Kim Kardashian's Instagram. Yeah, so what's the point?
Precisely.
Also, fun fact, that wig that she's wearing, when I went to the secret session, I try to drop this in every episode. When I went to the secret session, she opened her laptop to show us the Ready For It video. And we saw like her home screen. And the picture is of her and Joe kissing on a Polaroid in that pink wig. So I'm guessing it was taken around the same time. Ooh, isn't that weird?
You've never told me this factoid. That's very interesting.
Oh, well, here you go. And here I have an exclusive.
A juicy little morsel. That's very juicy.
So I can confirm that this is, in fact, a real picture, in case anyone was wondering. I do wonder if it was, like, the same night. I'm interested in the fact that Taylor likes wigs.
I just had, like, the most fucked up thought. I was like, why is she wearing that pink wig and always with him and kissing him and stuff? Is it, like, a weird, like...
Yuck. We can't. It's like thinking of Jesus giving a blowjob. Like, it's just not appropriate.
Exactly. I don't want to know about that. But now it's like I have this second peek.
But our opinion on that is that it was kind of nothing. But the strategy to bury it was very impressive.
It was. I'm still surprised.
Our power.
Yep.
You should all be afraid of the Swifties. Honestly, yeah. We rival the BTS stands. So we're going to go into the Zane Lowe interview, which I thought was super interesting, especially because she hasn't given a long form interview like that in a really long time.
What I was thinking is, like, I don't, because back in the day, I used to consume Taylor content like it was nobody's business. Like, I could, there could not be an interview without me watching it. You know what I mean? But in recent exactly. years, I've kind of felt like she kind of always sort of says the same shit. And I've watched so many mm-hmm. videos of her talking about her music that I'm like, this just isn't as fascinating to me as it used to be. But this was actually a pretty interesting fucking interview. And I'm happy that you made me watch it, because initially I wasn't going to watch it.
Yeah, no, it's good, because I feel like Zane Lowe asks really good questions. Oh my gosh, that's why I thought it was different. And he doesn't really let her get away with, because she is so fucking good at the PR spiel and spin and saying the same thing every time.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like he like has a rapport with her that allowed her to kind of color outside the lines a little bit. And the fact that she's even like referencing my boyfriend, Joe, like it's weird. It's weird to hear that, because she's been so Guantanamo Bay about it all.
Oh my gosh, and I loved when he was like, you know, talking about champagne problems, and they were talking about, oh, I wrote with Joe, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, well, I would ask Joe this question, but you won't let me talk to him. And she like laughed. I was like, put him on the camera. Put him on the put camera.
Smack cam, turn it around. Smack
cam. I know he's there. Put him on.
Also, she literally like in that moment, like briefly glances to the side. And it's just so weird to think that like he just sits there and listens to her, and then they go about their normal day.
Well, then also like when the phone rang and they're like a shadow passed over to go answer the phone, I was like, is that Joseph? Or is that fucking tree paint?
Is it him?
Yeah.
I mean, it could be either one. They're equally important life partners to Taylor Swift at this point.
Exactly.
But yeah, so a few tidbits that I thought were very interesting is that, I mean, the stupid debate about like fictional versus autobiographical is kind of reductive to me at this point, because I feel like almost none of these songs are entirely fictional. What I think her strategy going forward is that she uses a fictive situation and inserts moments of her real life. So the songs end up being like, Right Where You Left Me is a good example of that, because the first verse I feel like is very, it's about her. And then the second one, she kind of pulls away and makes a character and then brings it back to herself. So I think this is a great way. She's definitely painting it as like, oh, I'm not writing about my life anymore, but I think she is. And she's just telling us that she's not, so that we don't do our crazy shit and delve into her personal problems.
Well, and the other thing is that I don't think that any of us ever really considered how exhausting it must be to have to constantly like put your life out there, which is something that I don't think that she thought about when she was first getting started. But I think that if anything taught her that lesson, it might have been, I'm surprised it wasn't Red, but I think it was 1989 yeah. was like the final fucking straw. And I mean, Reputation is different to me, because it's kind of like, she was playing a character even then. You know, in half of those songs mm-hmm. she was. And then with Lover, she goes, I'm in love. And that's not really that interesting. But she was like, well, what the fuck? What are we just going to write about me and Joe being in love forever? No, because she knows that's not fucking interesting. Because, I mean, Lover.
And she's capable. Yeah, she's so capable exactly. of writing other things.
Exactly.
She just never let herself do it. So I think that like this pair of albums is really like a huge breakthrough for her in terms of like, I think her creativity going forward is really unlimited, and it's going to be really exciting to see where everything kind of turns after this, if she ever comes back to us.
Yeah. I was thinking a lot about that. Like when I was watching the Zane Lowe interview, I went into it with like the thought that she's going to be talking a lot about like, you know, I was looking for hints that it was about, like I was looking for hints about her, you know, taking a hiatus. So I was through that lens, I feel like I picked up a lot more because I went into it thinking that. And I was just thinking about when Zane Lowe was talking about, you know, oh, this album sounds a lot like Closure to me. And I was wondering if the Closure was referring just to the Folklore Evermore, you know, universe, or if it was more about like, in general, this is kind of like me closing the chapter on like maybe Reputation, Lover, and these two albums are all like a whole fucking thing. And now she's going to go away for a little while, just like she did before Reputation.
That's absolutely the feeling that I got. And I was very upset watching it, because I'm like, what is my purpose if Taylor Swift is like not around doing things? Because before, I guess if she took a break, like we could be guaranteed to get some like bonus content, maybe a soundtrack song or a couple of interviews here and there. But I think when she means hiatus, she literally means like dropping off the face of the earth and posting a photo of one of her cats every once in a while. Like that's what that means to her now, because her social media relationship has changed so drastically since 1989. Another thing that was interesting to me from this is how structured her past, as you said earlier, restrictive, how restricted and structured her past creation process was, almost that she got in her own way of like really reaching her creative potential. Because she talked about like how when she would make an album, she would think about having a stadium song, a radio song, and a crying song. And I feel like that is so, it's so hard to make something thematic and cohesive when you have those like very different elements going on. And it really just speaks to me about how fabricated Lover was, or like how deliberately structured and like purposeful it was, and not in a good way. Like a lot of it felt very forced to have all of those elements, which is why it comes across as like such a chaotic album. And freeing herself from those trappings has honestly like led her to some of the most interesting songs of her career. So I'm so glad that she stopped doing that.
And you're totally right, because like imagine having to force yourself to write a sad song. That's why I mean, like,
literally like, okay, sucks. Here's, this is why The Archer sucks, because she sat down and was like, okay, track five, and she like had it out.
Oh my god, you're so right, because that song, like, I mean, I'm the writing itself isn't that bad, but the fucking like the production of it, I just don't get it.
It doesn't make sense.
Did you see when I posted that it's my most skipped song in my entire fucking library? I skip that song.
Wow, it's your most skipped song.
Every time it comes up, I'm like, no.
It just feels like such a forced moment. And with Taylor, like, because she can come across as contrived anyway, when she does something that's obviously forced, you can really feel it.
Oh,
and track five is not a concept that she came up with. Let's not forget, like, the fans did the track five thing. We noticed it, we made the connection, and she kind of took it and ran with it, like the Easter eggs. Like, she kind of was like, oh, they love this shit, let me give them more. And it just kind of became a thing that she had to do instead of a thing that became organic.
No,
which is
what
we liked about it in the first place.
Frankly, I'm tired of hearing about it. Like, I've completely
shut up.
Stopped giving credence to track five as a thing anymore. It's like, I don't always believe that's going to be the saddest song on the record anymore. Because when it was a coincidence, it was good. When it's forced, it isn't.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I will say I thought that My Tears Ricochet was an excellent track five.
Yeah, on Folklore, that was definitely the most track five song that there could have possibly been. So that was a good pick. And for Evermore, too. She had a good pick for that one as well. But again, if she had put another song, like if she had put fucking Happiness on track five, I would have been like, yup. So there's just like a lot of different choices that she had, because she wasn't trying to force herself to write a sad song. She just wrote a sad song. You know what I mean?
She let it all come naturally, which was really nice.
Yeah.
But yeah, so she said that the one thing that I wish would go away is the reference to the cruel winter that she had when she got canceled, because that arrives again on this album. And I just want it to go away. I'm so sick of hearing, we've had Reputation, she said she was over it but really wasn't. On Lover, there were references to it on Folklore, and Evermore, literally the closing track is about that.
And so what I'm hoping is that with that last track on Evermore, she's that's it baby.
No more. Yeah,
because I think that, you know, it's like you try not to be shitty and be like, we're tired of hearing about this, because it's like, you know, it's like how she says in Right Where You Left Me, like, oh, everybody expected me to move on and then I didn't. And it's like, okay, I get you. Like, I understand when something hurts you, you don't have to force yourself. You know, if you're still hurt by it, by all means. But like, there does come a point.
Yeah, when you have
like,
to
really like girl,
give yourself.
You got to stop now. You just gotta.
You have to give yourself the space to move on and like have like your life is so good now. So why don't we focus on that?
Right.
And it just becomes like, it feels less important the more that we hear about it. Like, I think it really should have ended with Miss Americana. Like, just leave it there. You cried about it in that documentary that was not really a documentary. So let's just pack it in, girl, and move on, which I hope she will do after her hiatus.
Yeah, no, personally to me, like, I thought that The Lakes was a really good closing song for that whole thing. So I was honestly sort of surprised to hear more content about it on Evermore. I was like, didn't we? I thought you went to the lakes. Like, I thought
we. Yeah. Didn't we do this? Yeah. Didn't you dip? Why are you still here? So a few little factoids that I picked out of this. So she started re-recording the old stuff after Evermore and Willow. And she said there was a day where she recorded You Belong With Me and Happiness on the same day.
Which I think is insane. Which is, I think she's sick in the head for that. She has mental illness for that. She literally has mental illness for that. Like, what is wrong with you?
how she can pivot from those two, like, I couldn't think of more polar opposite songs to record on the same day.
Like, if she had been like, I recorded Cold As You and Happiness on the same day, I'd be like, oh, love it. Perfect. You Belong With Me and Happiness. No.
they don't go together. They're literally written by two different people.
Exactly. Literally.
She also said that, yeah. She also said that performing All Too Well is joyful.
I love that.
And so in my notes, I wrote she's a sadist because that is painful. But it is beautiful to see like the progression of how she, I mean, you can see it in her face. Like she's so proud of that song when she performs
it. Yeah. Oh, I love that.
And as she should be, snapped.
It's so good. I was going to say, like, it's just funny to think about, like, back in the day when she used to get up on stage and cry her fucking eyes out every single night on the Red Tour to All Too Well. Now she's like, I love playing All Too Well, and I watch Brokeback Mountain. It's like,
that is so true. Speak on it, queen. Speak on it. Another thing that I loved was, I think, some subtle shade at Justin Bieber, where she said that she had to give people space to, like, when she was asked about like mediating relationship conflicts with friends.
Oh my gosh, it's all I could think about. Selena. Literally. I kept waiting for her to say Selena's name.
People have to have space to learn lessons in their own time. And like, I learned that the messenger gets shot. And you know, like if you talk to your friends about their boyfriends, literally it's about Selena and Justin for sure.
She shot her ass down out of the sky. And it's like, I mean, I feel like that was the situation. Like, how long was this Selena and Justin nonsense going on? Like, perhaps if Taylor had said a little bit more, this wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, maybe we wouldn't have ended up here, but she learned her lesson.
I don't know if I fully agreed with what she said either. Like, you should just kind of like let it be and blah, blah, blah. It's like, okay, to an extent, but fucking Selena is like mentally ill over this shit.
Like, I think Selena Gomez is permanently damaged by that. Like, yeah, I don't think she is over it at all.
I mean, I don't know how much of that is to like, not because Taylor didn't say anything. Like, obviously she did try to say something and it backfired. So she stopped. But like, it's not always right to just be like, just let them learn their lessons. None of my business. It's like, girl, you got to say something at some point. Like, really? Yeah. So I didn't really fully agree with that. I mean, she had a point, but then she also kind of didn't.
I mean, yeah, if you're dating the guy who lives in his car outside Home Depot, your friend needs to step in. And
yeah, like, you gotta put a pin in that one immediately.
And I just, she said that she had no idea what the next decade holds. And the only thing on her list are places to see and adventures to have. And I was so sad when I heard it, but I also was kind of like, she fucking deserves it. Like, go and like live your life, do it. It seems like you've been so restricted by yourself. So like, go and be free, little queen.
Yeah. And you know, I thought about that too. I like, when she said it, I was like, girl, you've seen the entire world. And then I like stopped and thought about it. And I was like, okay, going to Japan and doing PR and doing concerts is not the fucking same as simply going to Japan.
Yeah. It's, you know, like plane, I mean? Hotel, it's press conference, exactly. Hotel, show, home.
Exactly. So I was like, you know what? I mean, when I think about her taking a hiatus, especially because she released 3 albums in the span of like a year and a half, it's like, I mean, she could go and not come back for like 3 or 4 years and not 100%. Have any new content. But then it's like, I'm thinking about like, holy shit. So the next time she's going to release an album, maybe, is when she's like 35, 36. She's going to be almost fucking 40. And I was crazy. Oh my God, I can't think about that. It's like, I can't.
No,
think
we
about
can.
It. It's too much.
We can.
And for all we know, she's going to get plugged up with a baby also. So
that's
it's like
what
this
I'm
whole
saying.
Fucking thing.
So I think she's taking a personal break as well to perhaps get married and conceive a child, because it seems like that is something she has been hinting towards like quite frequently.
It's fucking weird that they're still not engaged.
Yeah, it is. I think they probably are, and they're just not saying it.
Which, I mean, I did kind of notice she was wearing a ring on her middle finger, which I thought was fucking weird. I was like, who the fuck just wears one ring and it's on their middle finger?
I was it's like, suspicious what? To me.
It's odd.
Suspicious.
Anyway, and it's just like weird and invasive for me to even notice something like that anyway. And I'm sure that all she ever hears about is when are you going to get engaged. But it's not my fault because it's all she's fucking talked about. I want to marry you. I want to marry Joe. I want to marry him. It's like, well, fucking do it.
Give you my child. All right, then. Go exactly. Do it. Stop banging on about it.
Although, to be fair, maybe they're just waiting for the pandemic to be over so they can have, like, a real wedding, but I don't know. I mean...
Totally fair. I also do wonder, like, how much Andrea's illness is playing into the fact that she wants to take a hiatus, and that is an extremely valid reason to, like, go and do whatever it is that she needs to do, because the news that we've been getting about that has not been great, so...
Yeah, and the other thing is, like, the way that she spoke about Loverfest, too, sort of sounded to me like she has completely written it off and it's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. And if, I hope so.
With the way that Andrea's going, it's like, why are we even holding up the charade? Like, should I just get rid of my fucking tickets? Like, I'd like to know that because
yeah, I think she should say something.
$700 in the pot, so I mean, come on.
Yeah,
I like, think she should because girl. It sounds to me like she fucking already knows it's not going to happen. So it's maybe we should just kind of like shoot that horse already because it's halfway dead.
I also liked how she said she might want to start a band. That was so interesting to me.
I loved it because it sounds like so
I was
much
like,
fun.
Yes, queen, do it. Like, I just want from at this point, like, I love all the bangers, but we have so many of them and they're all so amazing. Like, Cruel Summer was really like, I don't know, her last hurrah as a huge pop artist. Yeah. So I'm ready for her to go and like do whatever it is that is different. I like the reinvention. I like her trying new things. Even when it doesn't work out, I appreciate the effort. So I'm ready. Whatever you have, Taylor, give it to me.
No, and I would love like an Aaron Dessner, Jack Antonoff, Taylor Swift band.
Oh,
fucking, I guess
yes.
Justin Vernon can maybe come, but
well,
honestly.
Well, the rumor is that she was working on stuff for Big Red Machine. She said it, which is like Justin Vernon and Aaron Dessner's band. She was working on stuff for them and it became Evermore. So I'm wondering if there's like a side project in the works there.
Well, to me, like thinking about songs that could be a band song, I feel like Ivy has that kind of like, there's so many harmonies in it. It's like, well, that could be a song that's a band song. I don't know. That's just kind of like immediately what springs to mind of a song that, but I don't even think that was one of the songs that she was writing for Big Red Machine because she wrote it with Aaron and Jack.
I would think Cowboy Like Me, Coney Island would be those songs for a project.
Okay.
Let's get into the album, shall we?
Yes.
Okay, so we will start with, first of all, I thought it was interesting that Jack Antonoff barely makes an appearance on this album.
I noticed that
too. He really is
too.
Not there that much.
Well, I feel like he's working on Bleacher stuff too. So I don't think it was like Jack's not here. I think he was just kind of like juggling a bunch of stuff. Yeah.
I have to say that the Jack Antonoff tracks on this record are my favorites. So maybe I personally am not ready to depart with him, but I love what she's doing with Aaron Dessner. So
yeah,
I'm happy with it.
Agree with that. Yeah.
So we'll start with track number one. I think Madeline is going to foam at the mouth. It's Willow with Aaron Dessner, production and writing. What are your thoughts, Madeline?
So this was a song that I had an idea of what it was going to be like because she was on YouTube, Vivo, whatever the fuck, answering questions before the video came out, like 20 minutes before the album came out. And I tried to leave, but I was just fucking sitting there waiting for the album to come out. So I was scrolling the timeline and I saw her say, oh, there's kind of like a witchy vibe to it. And I was like, oh, fuck, because that's completely in my bag. That's the kind of shit that I really,
in your
really
wheelhouse.
So
Halloween
in my
queen.
Wheelhouse. So I press play on the song and the instrumentals immediately, like, oh my god, this is literally the witchiest thing that she's ever fucking created. And it was the only song on my first listen through that I listened to twice because I just had to listen to it again because I thought it was the fucking best song I'd ever heard in my life. Literally so good. As time has gone on, I thought it was gonna be my number one forever. I don't think it's my number one, but it stayed in my top three and probably will. Because even though I can admit like it's not like the best song on the album, maybe it's not even like objectively top five, because there's a couple of things about it that are a little bit but it's like personally to me, I fuck with that song heavy because there's something about it that's just like different than anything else. Like, it makes me feel differently than any other song that she has, because like it's so, it just paints a picture. And I know that she's done so many like visceral, like very emotive songs before, but something about this one is like, I literally feel like I am in the year 1930 in the woods somewhere. Literally, it's that, it's just like, it's different to me. So I really like the song Willow. It's not the best, but it's up there.
It definitely has like the clandestine meeting occult vibe to it. I 100% see where that comes in. This song is not my favorite on the album. I think because your personal circumstances, like you're very much in love, you have someone who you like feel very drawn to, whereas for me, I'm alone. So when I heard this song, I was like, must be nice. It was like when Lover came out, I was in like a really dry spell, and I was like, fuck my life. Cause that entire album was like, I'm getting dicked down and I love it. And I was like, well, I literally can't relate. But I thought her vocals on this were really impressive to me, and her commitment to just becoming a better vocalist is, I think, the greatest trajectory of her career, because of all the criticism she got in the early days and just how different her voice sounds now. Like it is a very different vibe.
Well, the thing is that she had to find her vocal niche, because I think she was trying to find it for a while. Like if you listen to songs from Red, man, she was digging around in those pipes trying to figure out
what was screaming in State of Grace and whispering in Sad, Beautiful, Tragic.
Yeah, so it's like really interesting to hear like on an album like Evermore, like she's finally figured out like, yo, I can go down deep and it sounds really good.
Because that's kind of like, you hated falsetto, which is why I don't know why you like Willow, because Willow's chorus is very falsetto.
That's, you know what, you're spilling tea, and that's the truth. It's probably like in one of my least favorite things about the song, if I were to say, I do hate falsetto. You're totally right, because I don't think that it's her best, especially when she does it. Like I feel like it's just like, this would sound so much better if you just went down a little bit. Like I saw somebody covering Willow on like it was actually on like Thailand's Got Talent or something. Did you see this? It was very random, and they were singing the song, and at first I was like, what song is this, even though it was in English? And I was just like, oh, it's Willow, because she was singing it at a different register and it sounded so much better. So I do hate falsetto, but that being said, I feel like it almost kind of works on Willow, just because
100%. I mean, I like falsetto. I love her falsetto, so I think it works perfectly.
Falsetto specifically that I don't like is on Dress. I feel like that song, I would like it so much more if she did not do falsetto in Dress, because it just doesn't make sense to me. Anyway,
I would like you so much more if you would not say things like that about Dress.
Okay. I forgot that you were a stan.
A stan. So out of 10, what do you give Willow? I'm going to give it like a 6.5 or a 7. I think it's a bit boring. Also, wait, I forgot. Come back stronger than a 90s trend.
Dude,
why?
So that's the thing. Why? Like I said before, it puts me in a specific time era and it's in a space and the woods and the ship coming in and a really hot pirate getting off. And then all of a sudden she says, that 90s trend, it immediately snaps me out of it. I'm like, what the fuck are we talking about?
And then
about?
Fucking Lisa Frank pops into your mind and you're like, this is not at all matching with the rest of
I think chokers, I think crimped hair, like what what does this have to do with this beautiful love? Like, what are you talking about?
Nothing to do with the narrative of the song. I think she just, the wink part in the video as well. She really thinks she's doing something as well when she says it. She says it and like looks into the camera and winks. And it's just like,
I cannot believe
the serve that you thought it was going to be. It's just
that
not.
Aaron Dessner said, okay, yeah, let's put that in. Like, where was he?
He has better sensibilities as a writer than that.
He does.
I mean, her corny moments, she could really use an editor on. And you know what, Dessner, you let us down. What'd you think of the video, by the way? Did you like the video?
I did. It's kind of like, I like the Cardigan video more, because even though neither of them really followed like the narrative, and like, I get that she's like, it's not about the song, it's about, you know, the whole experience of writing the album itself. Because, but the Cardigan video, frankly, had better visuals. And in the Willow video, it's like, what the fuck? I'm like, I don't
know. I liked the part where she's in the box, the glass box. That was cool.
I love that. I loved that. That was great.
And I liked the invisible string. The invisible string was good, although it did feel a little overkill at times. It was like, okay, we get it. Like, we understand.
The part of the video that you'd think that I would like the most is when she's wearing the cloak and they're doing the occultist shit. Like, you'd think, like, oh, that fits the song. I hated that part the most.
Yeah, it somehow doesn't really work. I like the part overkill. where she's like, with the first part where she's with the hood and there's like a tight shot on her face. That's cute. But when it gets to the dancing part, I'm like, girl, what is this? And they're wearing masks. It's just too much.
And the Cardigan video was better. Damn.
Yes. And also, I feel like, for it to be a really great Taylor Swift video, there has to be a withstanding visual, like something that you will always remember. And for me, in Cardigan, it was just so meaningful watching her like cling to the piano in the water. Yeah. That was just so chef's kiss. It said so much about the record and like her as a person. Whereas in Willow, like the cage moment kind of almost gets there, but the rest of the video is not good enough.
It's really quick. Like, and she picks up the, what is that thing? It's not a guitar, mandolin. It's like a mandolin. Yeah, and she's just like jamming. Like, I get it, but it's a little bit like
it's off. On the nose.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I give it a 7.5. What did you give it?
I'm gonna give it a 9.4.
Ooh, 9.4. Yes. I see. We're very specifically doing our numbers today. Yes. All right, next song, Champagne Problems, with the one and only William Bowery. What are your thoughts, Madeline?
So for me, it's like, I understand why a lot of people have sort of connected to this song, because I kind of think there's like a layer to it, like a couple of layers, you know, talking about like, you know, when she says like, oh, the storm was once a madhouse, I made a joke, well, it's made for me. And then, you know, everybody says that she's fucked in the head. It's like, there's something there, like about like, feel like she can't commit and she doesn't know what's wrong with her and she can't fully like let herself have a relationship like that. She can't get married, she's not ready, all this other shit. Like, there's something there, like, it's powerful. But for me, like, a lot of some of the writing is just a little bit, it's either too like direct or it's like a little bit cheesy. Like, for example, your heart was glass, I dropped it. It's like, like, I mean, it's not bad, it's just like a little bit too corny almost. It's like, I don't dislike the song, I definitely, but the bridge is the high point and the rest of it I don't really care about. Like, I don't think like, no, Zane Lowe was like, wow, it's such a great song about unrequited love.
No, like, it's not.
I don't know about that, Zane. Like, it's good, but it's not for me, I guess is what I'm gonna say. Like, I don't connect to it really.
Zane Lowe, if you want to hear a song about unrequited love, you should check out 2010 Speak Now's Enchanted, because that is a song about unrequited love. That
and unrequited both ways somehow.
Exactly. I mean, oh my god, now you know, now I'm thinking about fucking Owl City. Okay, that song is ruined by that stupid idiot. But for Champagne Problems, my first issue with this song is that it sounds like New Year's Day, and I fucking hate that song. I detest New Year's Day. It sucks. I hate the little piano riff, and I don't know, Champagne Problems feels heavy-handed to me. And my thing with Taylor in this new direction that she's going in, I'm so glad that she's like writing so much and discovering things, but her instinct as a writer is to like really get into it. And this is where I think she needs an editor, which is why it's interesting that this is just her and William Bowery. Aaron Dessner does not have a writing credit on this song. If he did, well, I think it might be more concise, because Joe and Taylor Swift are sitting at home like bored out of their fucking minds being like, let's make up an entire novel and try and fit it in a 4-minute song. So I think it's heavy-handed. The fucked in the head part is good, though, I will say. We love that.
I like the entire bridge. I it's interesting to me to see people say that it's like the best bridge on the album. It's like, I mean, it's not. Just because it's really long doesn't mean that it's the best.
Yes, yes.
And like, I think that fucked in the head is like in like top 5 moments of the album. But I don't know. I give Champagne Problems probably like a 6. Because
yeah,
it's got,
I give it like a 4.
<It's>
I'm really not into this song.
But I think that it's kind of boring. Like, I don't really give a shit. You know what I mean? Like, I don't care about these people. Like, okay, yeah, you didn't want to get married. Is it really that deep?
And it's like, I guess it's about these like two young, stupid people cavorting around an Ivy League school. Like,
yeah, it's okay, like, oh, you guys were still in college and you didn't want to get married? Shock.
I know. What a surprise. What a shame you're so fucked in the head. So not my favorite. I'm going to give it a 4. Madeline gives it a 6. Moving on. Okay. So next up, when I was listening to the album, these first two tracks, I was shaky. I was like, better than Folklore? I think not, because we got The One and Cardigan, which was like seriously a 1-2 fucking punch in the face.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And for real. Willow and Champagne Problems were like not doing it for me, especially because Champagne Problems, like on a first listen, you have no fucking idea what it's about. It's one of those songs that you really need to revisit. And I was just, at the time, I was trying to make my way through this new shit, and I didn't like it. So we come to the third track, and I had been begging for an up-tempo moment. And what did I receive but a gift
from the bountiful
God? I got Gold Rush. And I have to say, this is, to me, one of the most sonically interesting songs that she has ever done. Like, the key change and the arrangement and how it has, like, a beat drop, but it's a really restrained beat, you know? Like, it kind of withholds so that when it does hit, it really impacts you. And to me, Gold Rush is, like, the spiritual sister to Gorgeous, because Gorgeous is definitely about that, like, you know, first glance feeling, holy ground, that like moment of seeing someone for the first time and wanting them so badly, but knowing you can't have them. And I love that this song is kind of like all constructed within a daydream. She's like, this is what I would do, this is what would happen. But then it fades into the day of my gray old tea, which reminds me of, I had some dreams. They were clouds in my coffee, you know, just like really hallmarky Taylor Swift moments in this song. And I think it captures something that we haven't seen from her in a while, which is that really restrained wistfulness. So I love it. It's also produced by Jack Antonoff, and I think that he always nails it with string production specifically. So I was so fucking jazzed about this song.
I totally agree. And I think whenever I think about Gold Rush, I kind of think of it as sort of like the August of Evermore in the production sense. In the writing, totally different, obviously. But I think that Jack, in August, he sort of hit the nail on the head in sort of like capturing the sound of what a memory would be like. He did that so well. And he does the same thing on Gold Rush. He didn't have to tell me that it was supposed to be a daydream. Like, I just knew, because the production was done so perfectly. The intro and outro, it's like fading in and then fading out. It's so nice. Like, it's perfect. Like, it's personally, I think that out of all the songs that Jack Antonoff has done for Taylor, I think that Gold Rush is probably one of my favorites. I think I have to give it to Cruel Summer, obviously, but Gold Rush is, you know, pretty close in second, because it's just like so perfectly done. I can't think of anything that I don't like about it.
It also is just the perfect confluence of each of their strengths. So like Jack's kind of arrangement skills and Taylor's like very succinct. As you all notice, Gold Rush is a super concise song. Like, there are specific things that are emoted and delivered very quickly. There isn't a lot of rambling. There's not a lot of space for her to kind of go off on a tangent. So I like that it's tight, and I wish it was a little bit longer. I kind of wanted another chorus. Just because that beat to me is like, it's so delicious. I just wanted it to come back one more time.
Yeah.
But I appreciate the whole construction of it. So I'm going to give it a 10.
I think I'm going to give it a 9.7.
All right. Higher than Willow. We have to stand.
We have to stand.
Okay. On to track 4, this is another favorite of mine from the album. It is "Tis the Damn Season" with Aaron Dessner. Madeline, I'm going to let you go on this one first, because I'm not exactly sure what your thoughts on this are. I think we have differing opinions.
I don't think that we totally do. What I will say is that this is a song that I don't necessarily listen to a lot, but I find myself thinking about it quite a bit. And one of my favorite things about this song is that it so perfectly, and this might be like a super American thing, but to me, it really captures like, it just makes me feel like I'm home for Christmas from college and I'm in a car with somebody and it's really dark outside and it's really cold and the streets are really icy and we're having a conversation. Like, it's such a perfect, like perfectly well done thing. It's like, I don't think Taylor has ever done this, but if she has, she fucking nailed it on the head, because this is exactly what it fucking feels like to be in that situation, especially when you're talking to somebody who was really important to you back in the day. And now you have this whole new life and you come back and you're like, oh, you still exist. And maybe I'm still kind of into you. You know what I mean? So I really like it. I mean, it's not in my top because I don't know. It's just not. But like, it's good. I like it.
I think that what Tis the Damn Season accomplishes, as you were saying about things Taylor Swift has never experienced, is kind of what she did with The Last Great American Dynasty, where she manages to inhabit another story so well that it feels like her story. And that's what I think is wrong with Champagne Problems, is that she didn't quite crack the, I didn't quite get her connection to it. Whereas with Tis the Damn Season, I can like really imagine that she has been in a situation, maybe not totally the same, but very similar to something like this, where you're revisiting a flame that you know, like for one night or something that you know is never going to go anywhere else. And you're sad that it's over, but you kind of want to like stop time and be there again. And that is why this song gave me Haler energy.
Well, it's really weird because what I thought about when I first heard it was, do you remember when she went back to Nashville and she's wearing a Christmas, this is a picture, she's wearing a Christmas sweater and she's in Starbucks and Drew from Teardrops and My Guitar is in the picture?
Oh my God. Do you remember that? That had left my brain. That's
literally what the immediate thought that occurred to me when I listened to the song was, that picture. I was like, oh my God, huh.
That's definitely what this is about. 100%. Also, this is the spiritual sister to Christmas Is When You Were Mine, which is the greatest Christmas song of all time.
Spiritual sisters today. I did not even fucking think about that. You're so right, though. That is so
true. It really is. It's like the grown-up version of it.
Yeah. And I mean, I love Christmas Is When You Were Mine, but it's like, I get kind of embarrassed. Like if somebody else hears it and I'm listening to it, it's like, all right, I know. I mean, it's a banger, but it's kind of embarrassing.
I forced my parents to listen to it and they were like, this kind of sucks. And I was like, don't ever speak to me again.
It kind of sucks. It does. But like,
No, it doesn't though. I think that it's like, I love the sad Christmas song genre. So when I saw the title of Tis the Damn Season, that was my prediction for the song. And I got exactly what I was asking for. I also love the bridge on this song. I think it's really good.
Oh, I love that. And I find it interesting that she thinks that sleeping in and staying in bed is like really romantic. You know what I mean?
I'm like, girl, that's depression.
Yeah, it's called depression. I don't know if that's like,
that's not a good thing, let's just say.
Yeah.
Also, I don't think she's ever stayed in bed a whole day. She's just not that kind of person.
It's hard for me to imagine it.
I just can't see it. I see her like waking up really early and doing watercolors or some shit.
Yeah.
Getting her day started. But yeah, so I'm going to give Tis the Damn Season another 10.
Wow. Okay. I think I'm going to give it like a 7.
Okay. I respect your opinion.
Okay. Okay.
All right. Track 5. Now we get into the absolute fucking pain. So here it is. Tolerate It. The only no co-write on the album. And you know what? It fucking makes sense to me. Oh, wait. No, it's not. I mixed it up.
No Body, No Crime.
Never mind. Yeah. That's the no co-write, which also makes sense. But Tolerate It, Aaron Dessner, you took us there and punched us in the face and called us stupid, silly bitches.
Yup, that's exactly the first time I listened to this song. You know, you could, when you listen to a Taylor album, you go into a track 5 and you're like, all right, this is gonna be sad, whatever. But I wasn't expecting this song. It's such a quiet sort of a track 5 because like there's no like, I guess you could say the final chorus is kind of a big moment, but not really, because the whole song is about sort of like being quiet and like, you know, like sitting and watching and like trying to do like better and like be better and like all this other shit. It's such a specific kind of like hurt, and it's sort of universal because I think that everybody has been in a situation where they're kind of like giving their all to a relationship and receiving nothing but scraps in return. So everybody knows that feeling, but this specific, like being in a marriage and having that fucking feeling must be awful. Like it's like, it's the pain of it, it's like I can't even imagine. And what I love the most about the song is something that I didn't notice until maybe like the 10th time I listened to it, but like in the final chorus, you know, she's talking about like, what if I, you know, left, like what if I just did, like, and I'm sick of this and I can't do it anymore. And then at the end of the song she says, I sit and watch you. So she doesn't leave.
No,
it's so, it hurts so bad. It hurts so fucking bad. Like I can't, it's so powerful. I love it. This to me, I can't even talk about it. It's so good.
It's kind of like Gold Rush in the sense that it is a entire story, like taken from one jumping off point, like a moment. Cause she like, it starts where she's sitting in bed and like resenting him and like wishing that he loved her. And it ends the same way. So she has this whole fantasy and she like recounts all of the terrible ways she's been treated and then comes back to it at the end, which is what I think is so painful about it, is that there's no payoff to this song. Like there's no like nice conclusion, which I feel like mm-hmm. she definitely does in songs like Love Story, you know, literally rewrites the ending to make it nice. And this song is just, it's such a poignant and like painful depiction of, to me, what I really felt was like an age gap in a relationship or like a maturity gap. I really felt that. So at first I was like, okay. So it's definitely about like a husband-wife situation. I can't really imagine her polishing plates, but I imagine that Taylor has experienced this feeling multiple times because she has been in so many strange emotional age gap relationships, like Jake Gyllenhaal and John Mayer, the cretin. I think it's absolutely inspired by that. But yeah, I definitely got that energy. Like this has Dear John vibes to it. Like I think this is really an expansion on something she's touched on before. And I think that Taylor, like, in her later relationships, she's very rarely not had the upper hand, which is why songs like songs from Speak Now hurt so bad, because you really understand that like she had very little autonomy in certain relationships or situations. And I think she definitely draws on that and Tolerate It. And I can literally hear the pain in her voice. Like she sounds very young in the song.
Yeah. Oh my God. When she says, the way that she sings, "I wait by the door like I'm just a kid." It's so powerful. Like it's so good.
And because she has a lot of emotional immaturity, like let's just be real with it. So I think that when she was 19, mentally, she was like 13 and she was dating this like old ass man. So I can really see how her like childish optimism just got like completely battered and bruised in certain situations. And I think that just comes through so painfully in this song.
Yeah. Whenever I was watching a video of her from like the Fearless Tour when she played her first stadium show, and that was around the time when she was with, you know, John or whoever the fuck, and I was like, how did these old ass men date this child? Because she acts like a child.
Yeah, she acts like a child. She looks like a child. It's just fucking creepy all around.
Yeah. Ugh, I didn't even think about it.
But yeah, so Tolerate It, I'm going to give it a 9 because I'm docking at one point because it just hurts too much.
I'm giving it a 10.
I'm not surprised. All right, track 6. Here is the only co-write, no co-write on the album. And Madeline and I had some back and forth about No Body, No Crime before we saw it was going to be on the record, because Madeline is not a fan of the Haim sisters.
Here's what I'm going to say. It's like, you know when you, like, something is good, but it's just not for you? That's Haim to me. Like, I just can't get into it. I don't get it. Like, it's obviously it's good, it's not bad, but it's like, I'm missing something. You know what I mean? Like, there's some level to it that everybody else connects with that I just don't get. Same thing with Maggie Rogers. Obviously, she's good. Mm-hmm. I can't get into it. You know what I mean?
I feel this way about Phoebe Bridges. Like, I just can't, I can't get into it.
Yeah, I that's because she's kind of the same. It's like Maggie, like, the writing is good. It's there, but I totally get how somebody would be like, it's not for me, because sometimes Phoebe gets a little bit like, you listen to one song and the next one, it's like, is this the same song?
Because I know she's like a weird mix of Lana Del Rey and Halsey, and it just like doesn't vibe with me.
Interesting. Okay. Well, yeah, but that's
it. Yeah, anyway, back to No Body, No Crime.
Yeah.
So we were a little concerned, but the best thing about this song is that they're kind of barely in it. I mean, their vocals add a lot, I will say. Like, their harmonies are really beautiful. So it works kind of how the Dixie Chicks really complimented Soon You'll Get Better. Like, they definitely added another dimension to the song. And can I just say that this is a fucking banger. It's like a bluegrassy, almost bluesy song. It's a real, the first thing I thought of when I heard it was Before He Cheats by Carrie Underwood. Yeah. I was like, this is totally that, like, or Earl, Goodbye Earl by the Dixie Chicks. Yes. I was like, this is definitely, I feel this energy so much. And these are the kind of songs that I want Taylor to write. Like, I love country Taylor. I will always stan. I always want her to return to it in some form. And this just felt like a very grown up, modified version of the country path that she's trodden down in the past. And I mean, we just have to stan someone killing someone. I can't really figure out who killed the guy. Like, I don't really know what's going on in the song still, but I'm a stan. I have to stan. I love the little switch at the end that she did in The Last Great American Dynasty as well. I just thought the writing was so clever and the song is really fun.
Yes, I was definitely pleasantly surprised by the song. I thought it was good as fuck. I was like, okay, all right. It's definitely not in, like, my top 10. Just because it's like, you know, it's just kind of like a story song that, and it's fun and it's like dark and mysterious and Taylor kills someone so you have to stand. But like, you know, it's just kind of like, it's cute. It's fun. It's nothing like super like amazing to me. You know what I mean? It's just good.
I did kind of want the chorus to go somewhere else. The chorus literally is just the same line repeated over and over. I kind of wanted another level there or some more vocals from her because it is a very like low, straight delivery. But personally, this is one of my favorites just because of the writing. So yeah. I'm going to give it a 9.
I think I'm going to give it a 7.
Oh, okay. That's good. Okay. I thought you were going to give it lower.
No.
All right, next track, which we are going to have. Now we're getting a series of snoozes, in my opinion. So, Madeline, I'll start with Happiness. So I don't like it when she says that she's written something based on a movie. Any song that she's done that for, I haven't liked, bar Death by a Thousand Cuts, which I really don't believe was actually inspired by that stupid movie. Happiness is, I believe, inspired by Marriage Story, which is just the worst thing that I can ever imagine Taylor Swift writing from Scarlett Johansson's perspective. Like, it just, I hated it before I heard it. I think that was the issue. Once I heard it, it just, I think I was so swept up in No Body, No Crime that when Happiness came on, I was just waiting, and it goes on forever. Like, it's one of the longest songs on the album. So I was kind of like, oh my God, when will it end? I do like the lyrics where she like interrupts herself. She's like, no, sorry, I can't say that. And I like the part where she's like, I haven't met the new me yet. I thought that was really poignant, but I just think that like the production is too spare and the melody is too simple. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Madeline.
So the thing about this song is like, I kind of get it. Like, I get why somebody might not like it so much. But the other thing about this song is that it's kind of personal to me. It's not that, obviously, I can't relate to it. Obviously, I've never been through something like that. Thank God. But, you know, it's like, I can't even bring myself to watch Marriage Story because I know what's going to happen. And it's not even about Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson, although that is a factor for me not wanting to watch it. But this song sort of addresses like one of my biggest fears in life. That has always been one of my biggest fears in life, is that someday it's like you're going to, you know, have this thing in your life and it's going to be your entire fucking life and you're going to dedicate all your time to it. And then for, you know, the thing that I get from this song is that there's no big betrayal. There's nothing giant. Like, he didn't cheat on her. And it's not like that, because she says like, you know, a good man hurt me and I hurt him too. And that could be any number of things, but nothing that, you know, like makes him the villain. Like she says in the fucking bridge, like nothing like that. Sometimes it just doesn't fucking work for any number of reasons. And it scares the shit out of me. And so that's why, for me, the song is so like powerful, because it's very deeply, it's literally like my biggest fear. So like, I
so
get
Taylor
it.
Nailed it,
yeah,
for you.
She really did. And I, the line that really like, and it was like 15 seconds in, I'm like, okay, I can't, I had to stop. I was like, I can't. But when she says, I was dancing when the music stopped, and in the disbelief, I can't face reinvention. Like, that is so fucking powerful, because like, that's just how it feels when like you make something your whole entire life. And it's like, you are this relationship, you know, this is who you are. This is what you do every single day. And then it's just gone. It's so fucking scary to me. It's like, I can't even talk about it.
Something I really respect about this song is what you said earlier. Like, it's a slow, like a rotting of a relationship. Like, nothing happens. It just kind of like, you start to stop loving each other, which is a really depressing and sad thing to experience.
Horrible.
And trust her to write a song called Happiness that is fucking depressing. But there's no conclusion, kind of like tolerate it at the end. It's like, there is happiness. I haven't found it yet. It's out there somewhere, but I can't harness it right now. And I want to, but I don't know how, because I'm like so shipwrecked by this thing that happened to me and to this person that I still love, but like can't be with anymore. So I totally get like the sentiment of it. And also this song does remind me of Hoax. So once I heard it, I was like, I know Megalodon fucks with
it's
this.
Funny because here's the thing is that you would think that like, oh, I have, you know, so many thoughts and feelings about happiness. It must be like my stance song like Hoax is. It's different, man, because Hoax is like a kind of pain that I crave. It's like, I want that. I want that. It's so good. Like, yeah. But then like happiness is like, I can barely stomach it more than half the time. So
yeah, like it can't be done.
Yeah. And another line that I really like is when she says, across our great divide there is a glorious sunrise. It's like, holy shit, are you kidding me with that line? It's fucking brilliant. It's like, I can't. It's so fucking good. And just I mean, to me, the song is the greatest song that's ever
the
been
writing
said. I mean, it's so
excellent
good.
And very honest.
I heard somebody say that like the bridge is kind of awkward, and I do kind of agree with that. Like, I feel like it goes off a little bit and it's not the same as the rest of the song. It's like, I kind of get that. So like that part is not great, but as soon as she goes back into the fucking verse, I'm like, okay, here we go, pain.
Here we go. Yeah. I mean, it's a nice little reprieve from your endless suffering.
Yes.
Yeah, I think this song could have done with some pruning. I think that's my main issue with it, is that it could be more concise and the production could be a bit more interesting. So what do you give it out of 10? A 10?
I give it a fucking 10, baby.
I'm going to give it a 6.
Are you kidding me? A 6? Are you fucking kidding me?
I don't listen to this song. Right. I literally never listen to this.
All right.
But back into, and for me, this is like the flop of all flops. This is like the total utter flop of this album. Track number 8, Dorothea.
I did not know that you felt that way.
I can't fucking stomach this song in the same way that I hated Paper Rings. It's like, I can't articulate why I hate it so much, but when I hear it, I have to turn it off. Like, I cannot listen to this. It is childish. It is boring. It is, it's just not, it's supposed to be fun and it is not fun for me to listen to. So those are my thoughts on it. What do you think about this song?
I actually really like Dorothea.
Not surprised.
And I really liked Paper Rings too.
Well, but, there you go.
For me, it's like, I wasn't really sold on it, but I thought that one line that she does, if you're ever tired of being known for who you know, you'll always know me, is, I think, fucking brilliant. I fucking love that shit. What I love the most about the song is that it's very like, yearn, like I like yearn, like come back to me, but like not in a creepy way. It's very subtle, you know what I mean? Like, he's not, I'm imagining, you know, who this person is that was in Tis the Damn Season. Also, it's interesting because Tis the Damn Season and Dorothea are related and they're about the same people, and you love Tis the Damn Season but you don't like Dorothea. So I find that interesting.
I literally hate Dorothea. I forgot. I just can't with it. It's so...
You repressed the fact that Tis the Damn Season is about Dorothea.
I choose to believe that they have nothing to do with each other, because Tis the Damn Season wouldn't even piss on Dorothea if she was on fire. That's how I feel about that song. It's in this echelon of songs that I hate. And like, they technically have nothing to do with each other, but to me, they're all linked. So it starts with Stay, Stay, Stay. That is the first strike, or Starlight, but more Stay, Stay, Stay.
Okay.
And then it goes into King of My Heart, which I absolutely cannot fucking stand. Then, and this is controversial, it's I Know Places. I also hate that song. And now we have Dorothea entering the fray. And you would think that Betty would be in there, but I actually love Betty. And I hate Dorothea. But can you see the links that I'm drawing between those songs? Paper Rings is there as well.
I understand the links between every single one of them, except for I Know Places. That doesn't fit.
Yeah, I threw that one in at the last minute. Let's just throw her out. Let's stick
okay,
with the
rest she's
of
out.
Them.
But the link is, I totally see it. Stay, 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 Paper Rings, Dorothea. I totally, there's a link there and I totally get it. I understand exactly what kind of song you don't like.
It's I don't know what it is. It's like, I don't want to say corny, but it's like this very unbridled enthusiasm that makes me feel embarrassed.
Okay. I love that.
That's how I feel about it.
Okay. That's fair. It's totally fair. I don't think that I'm like offended by anybody who doesn't like Dorothea, because really it's kind of like,
It's sort not of, a standout.
If you don't hate it, it's sort of a throwaway.
It's filler.
It's really just a cute little moment on the record. And I, you know, personally, I like Dorothea more than Betty. But I think that has more to do with all the hubbub around Betty that has sort of made me negative towards it, which isn't Betty's fault at all, or Taylor's fault, or anybody's fault, except for the fucking pieces of shit in this evil goddamn fandom. So, but
poor Betty. She just wants people to show up at her party.
There has been no discussion about Dorothea in the same way that there was about Betty. And I'm sort of baffled because, I mean, it's like the same fucking thing. But nobody's going to fight about Betty, or excuse me, about Dorothea.
Well,
like,
I think that the people who love Betty have fixated on Ivy, which I understand. I think they put that energy there.
Okay, no, you're totally right. You're totally right. You're totally right.
But for Dorothea,
that makes a lot of sense.
I'm going to give it a -1 out of 10.
Holy shit.
I really hate this song. Like, I was angry when I heard it.
I'm going to give it a humble 7.
Oh, wow. Yes. She's so generous to absolute garbage. Okay, track 9, Coney Island featuring The National. So I was so fucking hyped for this song because I love The National, like completely external to Taylor. I have been listening to them since high school. A lot of people liked Brand New. The National was like my Brand New. So I was very, very into it in that, like,
that is,
you know,
a very interesting link that you just made. A lot of people liked Brand New and you liked The National. That explains so much. I liked Brand New.
See, I feel like they're birds of a feather. Like the vibes are similar, but the execution is totally different.
I totally get that. No, you're totally right. Now that you've said that, I see it perfectly.
So Coney Island, wow. I was very excited to hear this. And on first listen, I felt that Bryce Dessner's voice like just didn't jive with Taylor's at all. Like I was so upset because I was so excited to hear them. Like I do feel like she collaborates with Bob a lot better than she collaborates with The National, just in terms of the singing. But as I've listened to it, like as I've gotten into it and gotten used to it, it's really slowly climbing up to one of my favorite songs on the record, just because I feel like it paints such a specific clear vibe. And like, I've been to Coney Island. I've sat on a bench hungover and been sad and like looked at the ocean and been like, I want to kill myself. And I feel like that is the vibe that we get in this song.
I love it.
And the writing is good. The production is really nice. This feels like the National song that's on a Taylor Swift album.
I love that for you. Have you fucking seen the, somebody did like a parallel between Uptown Girls?
Yes.
And I love that.
I loved that.
I absolutely love that. I thought it was so, and I'm not even like a Coney Island stan. When I saw that, I was like, yup. Because Coney Island really is that fucking place. And it's so ironic because it's like, happy, love, we're on, we're eating Nathan's hot dog, stuff like that.
But when you get there, if you go at
you
night.
You go there at night and it's different.
Oh, it's sad. When all the lights are different. On, but the rides are stopping and like the stragglers of the night are just sitting there like fucked out of their brains, getting high. Like it just, if you've been at night, you know that this is the correct depiction of this vibe. So I wonder if Taylor's like been to Coney Island. I would venture a guess and say absolutely fucking not, but you never know.
Yeah, it's really hard to imagine her at Coney Island, man, especially at night.
No. And I love the but I guess that would be the only time she could go without like having a complete
that's
circus
a really
around
good
her.
Point. That's actually a really good point. Yeah.
Did I close my fist around something delicate? I love it. And I love the hook of this song too. I just think it's really catchy and it has that slow build kind of like the last time that I really love in a Taylor Swift chorus where it like builds up and builds up and builds up. And it gets to this point where you're like, release. So yeah, I'm into that song. What are your general thoughts? Ooh, I also hate I don't like the not making you my centerfold line. I just think that's a little stupid.
It just makes me think of Playboy magazine.
Exactly.
Which
it
is
makes
not
me think of something indecent.
Yeah, which is not the vibe at all. My general opinion about Coney Island, I got to be honest with you. I listened to that song about 7 times. I have not listened to it a whole lot.
I knew you wouldn't like it because it's like the last time. It's not your vibe.
Listen, I know, baby. I know. Because that's exactly the kind of shit that just doesn't do it for me. And like, I thought this was the moment during my listen through where I had to pause and say that the writing is fucking insane on this record, because it is, because the writing on this song is so fucking good. And there's a lot of lines that I could pull from this. And I'm like, oh, that's so fucking good. But as terms of like sitting and listening to the song, there's something about it that just doesn't click for me. So I don't listen to it a whole lot.
I noticed that William Bowery was also a writer on this song, which is interesting.
And he's the fucking reason why I can't understand half the goddamn song, because I don't think he can fucking read.
No, he can't. Serious. I think he is really into Taylor writing fictionally. And I think that he pushes her towards that whenever they write together. And I think out of all their collaborations, Exile was the most successful, followed by maybe Coney Island and then Betty.
Wait, he was on Champagne Problems too.
Yeah, that's why I didn't put
Champagne Problems at the bottom.
Yep.
Oh,
yep.
That's why you didn't even mention it. You didn't even fucking mention it.
Doesn't even register to me.
Interesting. What's my favorite William Bowery co-write? I don't know. Fuck it. I don't know if I like any of his co-writes.
Exactly. Honestly, they're not that good.
Is there a single one? They're not bad, but
they're not amazing
in this way, but they're not my favorite ones on the record.
He's not a songwriter, and I need Taylor to stop trying to convince me that he is. I don't like this depiction of him as some like prodigious little British boy sitting at the piano being like, Betty, I won't make a sound.
And she's always like looking to him for like the male perspective. It's like, Taylor, you can't imagine. Like, I don't understand why we need Joe there.
Also, you wrote The Last Time. The Last Time is literally half a male perspective, and it is excellent lyrically. So you can do it. Leave him.
I think she says, yeah, exactly. Why does she need like a male's perspective on shit? It's like, where's this coming from?
Yeah, give him the time to flip through his B-movie scripts as an extra, and you stick to your job, which is writing excellent songs.
And I think that he's great on piano. Like, I like his melodies and stuff, but I don't know.
Don't write.
I mean,
she better never. If she sings with him, I don't want to hear that man sing. I'm just putting it out there. I don't want it.
I feel like there's a reason why he hasn't even done a backup vocal, and it's because she knows that his ass can't sing.
Well, she said
too.
He has this amazing deep voice.
Oh my god, I just remembered that from the fucking Long Pond sessions.
Yeah, he has an amazing deep voice, which to me sounds
like
she's being nice. It's not that amazing. He can like hold a tune. All right, so I'm gonna give Coney Island an 8 because I have to be in the mood to listen to it.
I think I'm gonna give it like a 6 because the writing is really good, but it's just not for me.
I feel that. Track 10. Now this I think is slowly vying for my top spot on the album. It's Ivy with Antonoff, no surprise, and Dessner. I am fucking obsessed with this song. The lyrics are out of this world. Like, seriously, some of her best writing ever. I love that it's telling a story. I feel like if you were going to latch on to any song on this album as the gay song, this is the song. Like, this is the, you could interpret it as like a wife talking about her female lover and how she wants to be with her. That is the kind of vibe that I'm getting from this song. And there's just something so addictive about this. And I think that it's because it's more of a pop song, especially with the chorus. And the vocals are just like so woodsy and enchanting. And I think Dessner and Antonoff together are way more powerful with Taylor than they are separate, if that makes sense. Like when they produce something, all three of them together, it sounds amazing. So Ivy is 100% one of my favorite songs on the album.
I completely agree. And I think that the writing on the song is absolutely fucking insane. And it's not a surprise to me. When I looked down and I saw that all three of them wrote it, I was like, yeah, it makes sense because this is fucking insanity. Like, the writing on it is like impeccable. There's not a single line that's bad. There's not a single filler line. All of it is good. Like, from start to finish. I can't get enough of it. And, you know,
it's a very folklore song, actually, now that I think about it.
It's kind of like a folk pop song because like you could definitely see this getting radio play, but also there's something that's very like woodsy and like mysterious about it at the same time. Like it wouldn't surprise me if she like had the sense to make this a single because it would do very fucking well. And one of my favorite things about the song is the repetition of goddamn. And I don't know why. It's just so good.
It adds another layer. It adds another dimension. It's in different areas.
And it's kind of why with every time that she, there are some times where I'm like, the swearing doesn't really add anything, but it doesn't take away. But there's other times where like this line would not be nearly as good if she did not swear. So I really like that about Folklore and Evermore, that she has the freedom to say fuck and shit like that, because like it, sometimes you have to say that. And it also makes the line what it is.
The bridge of this song just makes me go absolutely like, I go wild,
fucking nuts.
Feral.
I go fucking
like
insane.
It's feral. It is the goddamn blaze in the dark, and you started it, bitch. You.
It's a goddamn fight of my life. Do you hear me? Like, it's so good.
Unreal. It's like she's screaming at us, but it's so beautiful.
I tell you, this would be my number one song. I think it's objectively the best song on the record, but like personally, the only reason it's not my number one, I don't know why. It's just like there's a couple of other songs that are more
exactly. Probably.
But this song is definitely like the best one on the record.
It's impeccable. I really think start to finish, it's so good. And it goes on just that extra touch too long. And I think that makes it perfect. Like that final chorus really, whew, the vocals as well. So good.
So good. Oh my gosh. I didn't know that.
10 out of 10 for me.
Oh, 10. I would give it a 50 out of 10 if I could. But fucking.
Okay, well then I'm giving it an 80 out of 10.
I didn't know that Marcus Mumford was a backup vocalist on this track as well. I know,
isn't that crazy? It is. Makes sense though.
It does make sense. It makes perfect sense. Where does this guy come from, by the way? How does she know him?
All right, moving on to Cowboy Like Me. Now, Madeline, I believe that this is one of your Stan songs.
It is. And it's kind of strange because I find myself really sort of attached to it in an emotional way, but it's like, it doesn't break my top five ever when I do a ranking, but it's like, asking me now, it's like, I fucking love the song. I die for this song. There's something about it that's like, when I'm listening to it, I feel like I go to a higher plane for some reason. And it's like, when I think about it, I'm like, isn't it kind of boring though? But then I listen to it and I'm like, oh my God, like I can't. Like, it's just so, to me, it's like,
I think this is absolutely Brokeback Mountain fan fiction. No,
it is. And like, it's like, I know that. Exactly. That's why it's like, I can't, this song is gay as fuck. And it's like, I can't think about it any other way. I tried to be hetero about it and I can't. It's gay.
But that's
it just
why
is.
It's so compelling, I think. And also I like that the only thing I didn't like was the tennis court covered up with some tent-like thing. I was kind of like, you couldn't think of a better way to say that.
It's a very Death Cab for Cutie type of a lyric to me. That's what it makes me think of every time I hear it. I was like, Death Cab for Cutie would open a fucking song like that.
It is, yeah, I think this is an interesting song, and it definitely, like, again, she is leaning way more into the fictional narratives with Evermore than she is with Folklore. Folklore is more of a combination, whereas I think Evermore is, like, she's really going into, like, having a muse or a situation and jumping off from there, but I appreciate this song. It wouldn't be, like, one that I would come back to all the time. Definitely have to be in the mood for it. I kind of view this and Coney Island as, like, cousins, so I would give it a solid 7 out of 10.
For me, I think that the final verse really puts it over the edge. So, like, until that point, I think I would give it a 7. But as soon as she fucking starts talking about the Gardens of Babylon, I am in another dimension. So I have to give it an 8. Absolutely an 8. Like, it's so romantic to me.
It is. And it's gay, too, which it's just, like, makes gay. It 100% better.
Yeah.
All right, track 12. Now, this was a surprise to me because I thought that Gold Rush was going to be the only banger, but long story short, is the true banger of this album. And upon further reflection, to me, this could have been on Lover, which is so interesting because that is so not the vibe of Evermore or Folklore. And I like this song a lot, but there's something about it that is a little bit juvenile. I don't know if that's the right word, but there's something about it that stops me from super getting into it. But I will say that I think it's a continuation from Getaway Car for sure. And I love the part where she takes a moment to talk to her past self. That I always love those self-referential moments in her discography. So that was very special to me to hear, but not in my top five, I would say.
No, it's interesting because on my first listen, I'm pretty sure I had this as like top three. I was like, oh my God, I love this fucking song. It's so great.
Just because
it's
a banger, I think.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm thinking because it has just slipped lower and lower, which isn't to say that I don't like it, but I kind of agree with you. Like there's something about it that kind of like keeps me from like fully like thinking that it's the best song ever. And I think what it is that like, I don't know. It's like, haven't we been over this? That's kind of the vibe that I get from it.
Yes.
It's like,
this is a path we've gone down so many times.
And like, I get it. Like, she wants to really reiterate it. And like, this is her truth at really the does. Moment. This is her truth. She's living it right now. And like, that's great. But like, man, I'm just a little bit tired of hearing about how, Yeah, you kissed the wrong guy and blah, 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 blah.
And sonically, it's not different enough from Lover, in my opinion, to be on Evermore, which is such a stylistically diverse album. Because like, if we're doing her pop albums, Folklore is 1989 because it's a little bit more cohesive. And Evermore is Red because it's stylistically all over the place. Like the songs, the lyrics, the stories, they're all like completely different. But somehow it does work together as a body of work. But even on Red, there are like certain outliers that don't quite mesh. And I think that Long Story Short is that to Evermore.
I totally agree with you. 100%. Yep.
So I'm going to give it, because it's cute, it is fun, I'm going to give it, but it's also a retread, I'm going to give it like a 6.8.
Yeah, that's, I think I agree with you exactly. 6.8.
Okay. Well, we're moving on to Marjorie. Now, I thought that this was a very special, meaningful, touching song. Not something that I come back to all the time because it is sad and it's like hard to listen to. And I lost a grandparent this year. So I very much resonated with that kind of sentiment of feeling like someone who's departed is always with you in a sense and watching over you and kind of you're completing their journey from beyond the grave almost, or like following in their footsteps.
Yeah.
So I really appreciated and loved that part of it. But I think my favorite thing about it was when the sample of her grandmother singing, I thought was so special. And I just think that this is a very good personal moment that she let us experience with her.
I definitely, the best part of the song is when you hear Marjorie singing opera in the background, because the first time I heard it, immediately I was very moved by that part specifically, especially in the outro. Oh, it's so, it fits perfectly with, I think that Aaron did a really good job in putting that in, because opera and the kind of song that Taylor made didn't really mesh, but he somehow found a way to get it in there. And it sounds so beautiful in the outro. I really love that. For me, it's like, you know, this is kind of like a song that a lot of people have kind of like picked from the record and like written articles about, like, oh, this is the most touching song on Evermore. This is the most beautiful song. And we're going to write a whole article about why it's so moving, blah, blah, blah. And like, I get it. But like, for me, I was never really close to my grandparents. Like, it's not a song that I get, you know what I mean? I just don't, I don't latch onto it. So I never listened to the song because it is very beautiful, but it's just not something that is of interest to me.
It's not a come back and listen to it several times in a row, or I mean, it is kind of a skip in a way, not in a mean way, but just kind of like it's not super compelling. I get that it's personal and it's touching, but it's not like super amazing. But whenever I listen to it, I really enjoy it. I'm going to give it, because I think the personal element of it is so powerful, I'm going to give it like a 7.
Yeah, 7. That's what I would give it as well.
Moving on to a song that has been hotly debated on Twitter.com is Closure. Now, when it came on, I was so fucking confused. Like, just the intro to it. When it came on, I was like, what in the world is this? Again, this song to me doesn't live in the Evermore folklore realm. This is like maybe a Reputation Lover hybrid song.
Me,
it's like a Charlie XCX reject. I mean, I don't know.
It's like weird. A better version of I Forgot That You Existed. And to me, yes, I don't like the pots banging in the intro. I'm not crazy about that. The rest of the song, like when it's in the background, I'm okay with it. I really like the song. I mean, it's not a song that I'm like, best song, top five, or anything like that. But when it comes on, I'm fucking with it. Because it's very... she's kind of like, it's kind of like a send-off song in a way, but there's like a bitterness
to it.
There's a bitterness to it. And it's, I could eat that shit up. You know, I love that kind of shit.
Well, this is the Taylor we know and love.
Exactly.
I mean, I knew from the moment I saw there was a song called Closure, I knew that it was not going to be about closure because she's never experienced that in her entire life.
She's saying, not familiar with that emotion. She doesn't want it, baby. She doesn't want it.
Yeah. She's not interested. She's moving on. She got your letter. She's doing better. Okay, so I've seen like alternate debates. This is definitely autobiographical, and I am dithering between it's about Carly or it's about Scott, because I can imagine Scott trying to send her some like faux emotional letter, being like pleading with her to stop like antagonizing him in public. But I can also see Carly feeling guilty for doing whatever the fuck it was that she did.
Oh, I'm like 100% on the it's about Carly Claus train. I knew it the second I heard it. I was like, I know this is about that bitch. The way that she fucking says, when she says staying friends would iron it out so nice. And in, I was reading on the Apple Music, like I have the lyrics up. I don't know if you have Apple Music, but it's like, it's in quotes, friends is in quotes. And I know she did that deliberately. Ooh. She's being a little bitch just eat that shit up. I know it's about Carly. I'm like certain. Because
I'm dying to know what happened between them. And it also, it makes sense about like the something that needs to be handled thing, because every interview that Carly has been asked about Taylor since they stopped interacting, Carly has been like, yeah, we're really good friends. Like, I love her, blah, blah, blah. And it never rings true because Taylor will not comment on it, does not acknowledge her, did not go to her wedding. Like, there are so many clues as to how each of them are handling this situation. Taylor's obviously pissed and Carly's obviously trying to like keep an about face moment and make sure that it doesn't drag down her reputation, because she would absolutely get slaughtered if Taylor came out and said, I hate this bitch.
And the other thing that I always think about is that I get this impression from the way that Taylor has alluded to it, never directly spoken about it, even in the songs that are clearly referencing Carly. I get this impression that like Carly had no fucking idea at the time that she was pissing Taylor off this much, or like she thought it like mm-hmm. wasn't that big of a deal. And I think that Taylor, who was deeply hurt, like that pissed her off even more, that Carly tried to like brush it off like it's not even a big deal. It's like that.
And that's how she is though, Taylor. Like we forget, like she presents as like this very like calm, sweet person, but I think she has this, and this is what I find so compelling about her as a public figure, is she has this vindictive and vengeful side that is very, very powerful and kind of eerie and scary, because she is a powerful person in general. So whenever I hear her openly express that, I am scared for the person who's on the receiving end.
I know.
And
like, I mean, Carly, to me, she's kind of a person that I don't really give a fuck about. It's interesting to me that either. People...
If she got canceled, I'd be like, okay. Yeah,
people argue about her all the time. It's like, who are we talking about? She's
not that interesting.
Fucking broom. Like, why are we talking about Carly so
she
much?
She really is.
But I don't know. I love this song for that reason, because, like, she's just putting this bitch in her place. And it's so casual. That's the thing.
Yeah. She's like, no, thank you. Got it. Received. And I love how this is pretty much the public response to the letter that she received. I guarantee you she did not respond to that shit and waited to have her moment on an album, because that's the best way she knows how to get revenge. And we have to stand.
We have to fucking stand. So I personally, for me, like, obviously the song isn't the top of the record, but I like it. So I'm going to give it like a 7.5.
I'm going to give it a 6.5. All right. On to Evermore featuring Bob.
Bob.
your affectionate name for Bon Iver.
Yes. For me, I prefer this Bob feature to the Bob feature that's on Folklore. I think just mm-hmm. because I don't know, you know, Exile, I'm not crazy about like duets about a relationship. I don't know why. It's just not very interesting to me. So I prefer Evermore just because I like the pickup. I like Bon Iver's part. Actually, like, I think it's good. Like, I enjoy it. Like, it's fun.
Which
like
that means something coming from you.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think it's good. Like, I really enjoy listening to it. I love when he says, whether be the frost or the violence of the dog days. I think that's a brilliant lyric. I love it. But that being said, this is not a song that I'm going to all the time. I think it's at the bottom of my ranking just because I never want to listen to it, but I respect it for what it is. And kind of like what you said about how you're sick of hearing about her referring to 2016 being her darkest winter or whatever the fuck. It's like, yeah, I'm kind of sick of hearing that too. Like, this is very heavy-handed. The song is deeply heavy-handed. And it's like, you know that she's referring to 2016. So hearing her talk about, I was shipwrecked and I was in the wildest winter.
I know.
And then
like,
you
Taylor,
were there.
There's people that are dying, literally.
Exactly, dude. That's exactly the thing. It's like, this is not... Like, I understand it deeply hurt you, but, like, we've heard about this so many fucking times. And to me, like, The Lakes is a better song. And for some reason, mm-hmm. I think that they're kind of, like, two sides of the same coin. And to me, like, The Lakes
does it better. I feel like Evermore is, like, the prologue to The Lakes.
I feel that.
It would come first, and The Lakes would come after.
Yeah.
Because Evermore is, I don't know, I feel like... As a closing song, it is excellent because I hated New Year's Day. I think that Daylight is trash. Literally, Daylight is like the worst example of Taylor like forcing a conclusion.
Ooh,
and I see what you mean, and that this is heavy-handed, but it's the musical part of it. Like the arrangement is so beautiful to me and the piano part is so seductive. And I think the chorus is just so catchy. And I really feel like it's her taking a breath and like finally exhaling. And it does come to a conclusion and it's a little heavy handed, but it doesn't feel forced, which is what I got from Daylight. It really felt like she was shoving a conclusive ending together that didn't belong. Whereas to me, this does kind of cap off the album in a really interesting way. Maybe not interesting, but in a very fitting way. So I'm going to give Evermore a 8 out of 10 because I'm coming back to it a lot lately.
I think that, I don't know. I guess I'll give it a 6, I think.
All right, fair enough. I can understand your perspective.
Thank you.
So let's get into the deluxe tracks, which infuriatingly are still not on Spotify. So I just haven't been able to spend as much time with them as I would like to.
I can only listen to it in my car because I only have it on the CD, and that's the only CD player I own is in my car. So it's the only time I get to listen to it, and it's fucking infuriating because I want to listen to Right Where You Left Me pretty much all the fucking time. So I'm pissed.
So I was just so not expecting Right Where You Left Me to be what it was. I was so astounded by like the sound of it purely. Yeah. It made me so nostalgic. It really made me feel like she is getting in touch and like finding her way back to the sound that made her. And it's that kind of country song that I really like because it tells a story, but it's also like kind of fast paced and like picky and plucky, and her vocal delivery is so good. But the chorus just really fucking gets me. The pre-chorus and the chorus just really, like that image of her staying frozen, sitting in a restaurant after having like a conversation with someone she can't bear to look at anymore is just so powerful. And I stan. I love the song.
I definitely, and what I like the most about it is the first time I listened to it, I was kind of like, what the fuck are we talking about here? Like what restaurant, what? And then like, as I listened to it more and more, I kind of feel like the her being in a restaurant after having a conversation with somebody and glass shattering and all this stuff is really just a metaphor for an entire event occurring, not just a conversation, but like a whole fucking smattering of events that people told her to get over and that she couldn't get over. And to me, that's kind of what I love the most about the song, is that I know exactly what it's like to be holding on to something that everybody tells you to fucking get over. And it's like, well, it's like you can't. And then everybody mocks you for it. And it sucks. And it must have fucking sucked to be her, having people tell you, get over it, get over it. And I love when she says, did you hear about the girl who lives in delusion? Breakups happen all the time, no need to lose it. And it's like, treated her all the fucking time. To me, this song could have been on fucking 1989.
Or Red, even. Yeah, this is a Red song to me.
It's so like... it's so old Taylor meshing with the new Taylor. It's like, I absolutely love this song. I could listen to it 1,000 times. It's like fun at the same time that it's also very poignant. Yeah, it's very good.
I also love the lyrics of being 23, still inside your fantasy, yeah, the girl who got frozen. Because my theory ever since Miss Americana is that Taylor is like very severely emotionally stunted and she's like stuck at a very particular age. And usually that age comes across as like a 15, 16 year old, which is not great. But this to me is her stuck in her Red days, where I think that like Red was such a catharsis album and it was so like trying desperately to get over something and to work through something and make something productive out of a horrible situation. And this to me is kind of like about the process of doing that, you know, like before she was able to reconcile it and put all the pieces together, she had to have that moment where she was stuck and like be frozen and stay where she is. And the fact that she chose 23 is like, that's when she was writing. That was like just after Red. And I get that vibe. But in terms of who I think this is about, I'm getting, again, Scott Borchetta and Karlie Kloss vibes. My theory on the whole Karlie Kloss thing, what happened, because we don't know. My theory is that she had been, because Scooter's her manager, is that she had been feeding information to him, probably unwittingly, like just saying things offhand, that somehow helped Scooter trump Taylor in some way. Or Taylor has interpreted it as it led to her masters being taken away from her. So I think Karlie played a part in that process and she felt very like attached to her. And I think in It's Time to Go, we get that thing about the twin sister, that whole line as well. So these two songs for me are about that situation.
I totally agree. And that's kind of like, it's interesting that she kind of like pairs them together by making them both bonus songs, because I really do think that they are deeply related to each other. I think that they're kind of like about the same thing in a way.
I also instinctively know in my heart that the Master's drama and her Carly Kloss drama are inextricably linked in some way. Like Carly had something to do with that great betrayal, because there really, I don't think, is another explanation for that, unless you want to get into the like Kaler fantasies, which if you do, then there it is. But I think that there was some sort of business decision that Carly was being double-handed in.
I totally agree with you. I think that Scooter and Carly totally fucking linked. And so in that way, the Master situation and Carly are totally linked. And obviously this Master situation has been like a great source of pain to Taylor. So of course, Carly also is going to be a great source of pain to Taylor as well, which I don't think Carly fully ever realized.
Maybe she does now. I think maybe Carly doesn't realize exactly what it was that she did. I think Taylor probably has a better idea of what exactly she thinks Carly did to her.
And to me, Taylor's definitely the kind of bitch who just like fucks off and then writes a fucking song, and then you hear it and you're like,
what that? You're like, what? Why?
Exactly.
You're like, damn, is it that serious? And she's like, it fucking is, bitch. I got your letter. But this song, I got really emotional when I heard this song, purely because it was such a classic Taylor moment that I feel like we haven't gotten in so long.
I think that I would give this song probably, I don't know, maybe an 8.5. I would give it.
I'm giving it a 9 because it's not on fucking streaming. So how could I possibly appreciate it properly?
Exactly. Oh God, I want to fucking stream that goddamn song. I get mad about it every single day.
I know, it's so irritating. All right, we're here. We're at the end of the album. It's time to go. What did you think of this song?
I do not care about this song. I appreciate it for what it is, but I don't like the narrative. I don't like the switching between different situations, because it's just like the situations that she uses, like leaving a company after 40 years. Like, I understand. I get what you're trying to say, but it's not connecting with me at all. I don't really care about the song. And I think it's fucking hilarious that she refers to Carly as a crook, because that's funny as fuck.
This is absolutely a sister song to Right Where You Left Me, for sure. These songs are like definitely related. I think, the Carly tea is pretty intense when the words of a sister come back in whispers that prove she was not what she seemed, not a twin from your dreams, a crook who was caught. I mean, she can't be clearer. Like, she literally cannot be more clearly telling us who this is about.
She wanted us to know what it was about Carly, like 100%.
She wanted us to know, and she tried to throw us off the trail with all this like other shit, but it didn't work. I think the company thing might be a metaphor for like leaving Big Machine.
Exactly,
the 15 years, 15 million tears. Like, she met Scott in like, 2005? And then started her recording career in 06. So kind of works out to about 15 years, begging till my knees bled, wondering, then I gave it my all. He gave me nothing at all. Then wondered why I left. Then there's that whole thing of him praying to his greed. That to me is very much about Scott Borchetta for sure. But the highlight of this song is he's got my past frozen behind glass, but I've got me. I love that. That part is amazing. And then the rest of it, I'm kind of like, okay.
Yeah, I don't like the weird, like, intro. It's very ominous for, like, what the song ultimately is. So, I don't know. It's like, I don't click with it very much at all. I mean, like, I love the frozen behind glass bit, but it's like, I mean, it's no My Tears Ricochet, let's be honest with each other.
Oh, it's no,
it's My Tears Ricochet. To me, the song is like a 6, maybe. Maybe a 5.
I'm going to give it. I'll give it a 6 as well. I think that it's just because the other bonus track is so legendary. It's hard to compare.
Yeah, it's really hard to compare. And it sucks that It's Time to Go is like the ultimate ending of the album. Because, I mean, I guess it kind of works. It's Time to Go.
Just the title is the only thing that works about it. I wish that. But that also, don't you think that's an ominous hint as well? It's Time to Go.
Yes, I knew that you were going to say that. I think that, I'm just wondering, for her fucking hiatus. I think that, it's interesting to me to think about, because I'm wondering if she thinks like, now this is my time to kind of like go and like not be here. But it's weird because to me, Reputation kind of feels like it was like 5 seconds ago. So it's like, when I think about it, it's like, didn't you just go on a fucking hiatus? But I don't know. It's like weird. And it's like, obviously she has to take a break at some point. And she just released 3 fucking albums, like back to back to back. So if she did take a hiatus, it wouldn't surprise me. But it's like, but how long are we talking?
For how long are we going to be doing this?
Yes, for how long are you going to go away for? Because she definitely deserves it. But, and then it's like, I really can't imagine her pushing 40 and making song. You know what I mean? Like, it's
me either. I also can't really imagine her stopping. I think that songwriting is so ingrained in her as a therapeutic device, not just as a career thing, that like I can't really see her stopping, but I could see her like kind of pulling a Beyonce and shifting towards other projects that aren't necessarily her albums.
Interesting. Very interesting.
But overall, I think Evermore was definitely, I was afraid it wasn't going to be good, and it was definitely good. I personally like Folklore better, but I can definitely appreciate that there are high points on this album. And my big thing is always like with her new releases, I want her to try something new on every single one. And she definitely did that on this. So I'm pleased with the final outcome.
For me, I think that Evermore has more stuff on it that I kind of really connect to. For Folklore, I kind of felt like, I don't know. It's, to me, Folklore is like a mood record. Like, it's mm-hmm. like, I've got to be fucking sad as shit to listen to Folklore. But on the other side of the coin, it's like, there are songs on Evermore that, to me, are even fucking sadder than anything that's on Folklore. Yeah. Like, fucking Tolerate It, mm-hmm. next oh, fucking for sure. level. Yeah.
It's this has deeper depths on this album.
It she goes to different places than she went on Folklore. I feel like Folklore, she was holding back. And I think that she focused more inward a lot, because I think that she still felt like she had to sort of focus inward. And to me, there's so much less of like her personal stuff on Evermore. And also, this is sort of like trite as it, you know, in comparison to everything else, but I like the album cover for Evermore a lot more than I like the one for Folklore. The picture of it makes me like, I just love it so much more. I don't know why. I think it's because it's in color, and it, like, to me, the Folklore album cover is just kind of like a blob, and then she's in the middle. But I love the Evermore cover. I love the braid, which is funny because I hated it when I didn't know that it was for Evermore.
Yeah.
So it's funny to me that I love it now, but I don't know. In general, I'm just like more drawn to Evermore, and I don't know if that's just like recency bias or what, but I'm definitely
could
more,
be anything. We yeah. need to live with these albums for a bit longer. Yeah, we're not like, used to having this much content to digest. Usually we have 2 years before we start to talk about like how we felt about the era as a whole. And so these two albums are sisters. Like, it's, I don't think they're individual bodies of work. I think collectively they are one.
And it's really hard. Like, I was trying to do the Folklore and Evermore song ranker, and I did it, and then it came out, and I never like the way it comes out because it doesn't feel
yeah, me either. Right. I can't do those rankings. It's too hard.
It's too many. And people are fucking sitting there making their album rankings. It's like, how are you people doing this? How? Because I can't rank them anymore. Like, I'm done. There's 9 of them. Like, I can't put anyone. It's like, I'm really going to put Reputation above Folklore and Evermore? No. Where the fuck is Lover going to be at the bottom? No. Where's Red going
to
be?
I know.
Like,
it's so hard to rank with the pop albums as well. Like, there's just no comparing. So ranking is like a really impossible
task. How do you
task.
Compare 1989 to Folklore? Which, like, 1989 is her like critically, next to Red, is like her two critically yeah. acclaimed like best albums. Where it's like, you're really going to say that Folklore or that 1989 is better than Folklore, but you can't compare them. It's impossible to say. I can't say it anymore. So I quit. I'm not ranking them anymore.
Thank you guys so much for listening to The Evolution of a Snake. Please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever it is that you listen. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at T-Swift Podcast. And we will be with you again, hopefully very soon. We're working on the 2013 episode. And thank you for listening.